We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Dr. Glenn Miller. He's the author of a very helpful book just out called Empowering the Patient: How to Reduce the Cost of Healthcare and Improve Its Quality. Welcome, Dr. Miller.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Dr. Miller is a Mennonite, and you've spent some years abroad in Haiti and India, as well as your practice with patients in Ohio and teaching internal medicine. Tell us a little bit about the Mennonite Central Committee and how that was involved in some of your medical work overseas.
Yeah, so the Mennonite Central Committee, first of all, is a national organization that works internationally as well as locally in development, areas of development, working with poor people. In India, MCC went there in 1942 in response to the war and to a lot of refugees. And so, for example, in India, that's the longest-serving program. It's been well over 50 years now that MCC has been in India. It works in approximately 55 countries, works primarily with volunteers, volunteers who represent all sorts of skills as well as people who just have time that bring their experience to that new endeavor.
And you and your wife went to India when? I know you stayed about 7 years.
Yeah, we stayed there about 7 years. We went there in 1990, and I left my medical practice at that point, and we went to India, came home in 1997.
Now, when you went in 1990, you recount in your book that some of your colleagues were a bit appalled at that. You were at the height of your practice. You were probably at the highest point of making a good living. What prompted you to do that?
Yeah, that was one response. A pathologist friend told me, "This is stupid. You are at the height of your prestige and your earning power. What are you doing?" Uh-huh. Well, he didn't. When I said, "Look, we're going to India to work with poor people," that changed the tenor completely.
Okay.
However, the other reaction was very interesting. I also had a number of colleagues, a few colleagues at least, who said, "Wow, I wish I could do that," uh-huh. as well as some lay people, some people who are not in medicine. Said, and so when I check with them and say, "Well, now let's figure out why you can't," it's almost invariably was because their lifestyle was such they could not afford to leave it. They had to have the day to day income to in order to be able to sustain their lifestyle.
Well, tell our listeners about some of the practical things you had to do. You and your wife, did you sell your home? Did you rent it? What did you do about that?
No, we sold our home. We lived in a small town, 15,000, Belle Fountain, Ohio, for about 25 years. We sold that home, and it was a very interesting process. My wife called it deaccumulation. 25 years in one big rambling country home, and you accumulate things. And actually, it felt quite good to deaccumulate.
And you had previously had an experience abroad in Haiti. When was that in terms of your medical career?
Right. I graduated from medical school in 1961. And then right after internship, and in those days, there were many fewer postgraduate training programs. For example, in family practice, there was essentially none. They're just in the process of developing. And so right after internship, we went to Haiti. We were there for 2 years.
Now, was that sponsored by some church group or not?
That was with Mennonite Central Committee. That's right.
So when you started medical school, was this one of your hopes that you could do this kind of medical work?
Well, yeah. I date my call, if you will, to become a medical doctor to time when I was 12 years old. And I was I read a book. It was called Dr. York, Hill Doctor. I read that book through in practically one sitting, and I put it down and I read it again. And I decided I wanted to be like Dr. York. Dr. York was a doctor that gave up the big city and the bright lights and went to the hills of eastern Kentucky and served the hill people, people who would not have had medical care. And I decided I wanted to be like Dr. York.
But you came from a poor family. I think you said you have eight brothers and sisters.
That's right. You read the book well.
And your father could not afford to send you even to college, let alone medical school.
That's right. My father was sympathetic with me going to college, but left me know I was fourth in the line of nine. He left me know that he didn't have money to send the older ones to college, and I think I was probably the first one that I was actually pushing for that, but you may go, but only if you find your way there. So actually, I was out of high school about 3 years before I started into undergraduate school in a pre-med program.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Glenn Miller. Dr. Miller has written a new book called Empowering the Patient, How to Reduce the Cost of Healthcare and Improve Its Quality. We're not encouraging phone calls today because this is a pre-recorded program, but Dr. Miller spoke just last night at the First Mennonite Church here in Urbana, and so we're recording this when we have him available, but that means listeners will not be able to ask questions or make comments. I'll do my best to anticipate what some of those might have been. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. You have a subtitle for your book. All right, maybe it's a subtitle, Learning to Relate to Your Doctor in a New Way. In all of your experience, both in this country practicing medicine and in other countries, why do you think that's important?
Well, you know, Steve, I grew up, as did everyone in those days, the doctor was a special person, a set aside kind of person who had almost magical information. He healed, and nobody exactly knew how frequently.
And in your generation, it was he usually.
That's right, exactly right. And that has changed, fortunately. But and so the doctor was almost a mystical person. Over the years, that has changed, and I saw that change come about. I saw the change come about with both in patients because they had a lot of new information. I mean, these days, with a click or two of the mouse, you get right on internet, and there are places where you can find out what's wrong with you and how to treat it.
Well, there are wonderful resources, but it's often hard to tell what's right and what's not quite right.
That's right. And that's why you need a collaboration with an expert. But the other part of the equation is the way doctors are being trained. These days, doctors are much more being trained to listen carefully, to actually enter into this collaborative arrangement with their patient. I say that I'm talking about a primary physician. I'm talking about the primary doctor. Usually these are family practitioners, internists, and pediatricians. Sometimes obstetrics are included in that group.
And when you first had the idea for this book, I think it comes across very well. It's well organized. It's easy to read. It's very helpful. You have many lists that tell what patients should do in different circumstances. I find it a very helpful resource. But when you first had the idea for it, what kind of a book did you want to make?
Well, I didn't know. What I did know is that there must be a better way. In the book, I recount kind of the seminal event when, after church, a friend of mine came to me and said, "This week I have an appointment with a doctor that's going to look at my stomach." And I said, "Why?" And he got this very pained look on his face and said, "I don't know why." He said, "I get so frustrated with myself. When I get to the doctor, I get tongue-tied. I can't think of a thing to ask. Now, this person has had a lifetime of communication.
I see.
He's a writer and he's a teacher. And I thought, well, wait, something is wrong here. A person like this needs some tools, needs some ways, needs to find ways to gain confidence as he enters the healthcare system and makes decisions with his doctor.
You suggest some very practical things like taking notes in with you and taking notes with what the doctor said, or bringing someone with you who is not maybe so emotionally involved, who can also listen and take notes and help that conversation actually occur.
Yes, sickness is an emotional event in many ways. And so people are, particularly when it's serious news, people get very concerned about and they don't hear it. The emotions get in the way. They walk out and they say, "Now, what was that about?" And so, to either take a recording, take someone with you, take notes. That's really very helpful.
When you started putting this book together and you decided how to write it, I found it very helpful that you first give a dilemma, a problem, an issue. And then you give someone's story, an actual patient. How did you get those stories? Did you make them up? Did you take notes? Did you ask permission to record what people told you when they came to visit?
Well, Steve, if you start listening and you get a reputation, everybody's got a story, either themselves or their family. It's amazing. And so all you need to do is say, "I'm looking for stories." Some of the stories in the book, a couple of them are actually written by other people, but most of them were people as told to me. And I, after I read, wrote that initial story about the fellow that was going to the stomach doctor, I just left to be known I'm looking for stories. And people started coming to me, and then I sorted through them. And now some of the stories also go back a few years to my own experience as a healthcare provider, as a medical doctor, when I was seeing patients.
And some of the stories are, you can hear different people's voices and different people's personalities in them. I think it captures the diversity of who patients are very well. And I suspect that you got some stories because of your own sensitivity. When we were walking down the hall here, we just met, and you said, "I see you have a little problem with your knee." And I did have knee surgery just last January, so I can see how you get stories.
Always the clinician.
Now, you went back to school after practicing family medicine got additional training in internal medicine, is that right?
That's right.
And then you later ended up teaching that.
That's right.
When you were teaching, did you find that the students you were teaching were very different than you were when you were a student yourself in medical school?
Students, I think, when I was teaching, they are being taught different. They come in with different expectations. I don't think the bedside manner gets a lot of emphasis. How to listen carefully, how to work with a patient in various ways, so in essence, I think the patient is saying to the doctor in this collaborative arrangement that I talked about. The patient is saying to the doctor, "I want to be involved in my own healthcare and in the decisions. I want you to, I respect your judgment and your information. You have information that I don't have, and I respect that, and I want you to participate with me." The doctor, on the other hand, in this collaborative arrangement, is saying to the patient, "I respect your right, and I welcome your participation. And together, we want to do the best we can for your health care and to increase your potential health and your future."
You mentioned early on in your book, Empowering the Patient, that people who go to their doctors, if the cost of medical care is important to them, they should say that to the doctor.
You know,
it seems like an obvious thing, but I'll admit I've never done it.
Well, I would challenge listeners to go to their doctor, and when they have a procedure, for example, a scan, ask your doctor, how much does that cost? Let me tell you, most doctors simply don't know. Most doctors don't consider it part of what their job is. And I was there. I know the feeling. You want, your job is to give the best possible medical care. And so when a question of cost comes up, you say, look, I got people in the front office. Go and talk to so-and-so, sure. And she'll explain this to you and how much it costs. So what I'm saying is the doctor is not a person who automatically assumes that cost is part of what he does. I know of some doctors who say cost enters into every decision I make for a patient.
Oh.
And that's
unusual.
That's unusual. It's also very commendable.
Yes. Now, one of the places that really is important and very helpful immediately often is in prescriptions. Because if you tell your doctor, look, I'd like to be given good care, but I'd prefer it be done as the most economical way possible, either because I'm paying for it or because I don't want my insurance rates to keep going up. Tell listeners why that matters.
Well, maybe I can just tell the story in the first chapter of the book.
Sure.
My own experience. I went to my cardiologist, and he said, well, you need an antibiotic for your cough. He said, do you have drug insurance? I said, no. So he said, well, I was going to give you an antibiotic that costs $550 for 10 days. He said, but I can give you the same medicine at lower cost. You're going to have to take it twice a day instead of once a day. He said the reason the newer one costs more, he said they reformulated it so they could get a new patent on it so they could charge the higher price. He said, in my judgment, the old medicine is just as effective. He gave me that. I got better. When I went back in 6 months, I said, you said that the old medicine was just as effective, and yet it cost only 20% of the newer medicine. I said, why would you even consider giving me that more expensive medicine? And he said, well, I thought that's what you would want. Now, when I thought about that, I thought, well, when he sees a lot of people, most of them are not doctors like myself. And most people come in having heard a lot of advertisements saying the latest medicine is by far the best. This is the one you need. Your life will not be complete without this medicine and all that sort of thing. And so they come in and they may feel they get inferior care unless they get the latest medicine, which is always the most expensive. The latest medicine may not be any more efficacious, may not be better than an older, much cheaper, or generic form.
You point out in your book, Empowering the Patient, that the United States and only one other country, New Zealand, I think it was,
that's right,
even allow medicine to be advertised on television.
It's amazing. If you watch an hour of television, particularly at certain times of the day, just count up how many are for medicine, how many advertisements are for medicine. As a medical doctor, now retired, I really do get very tired of hearing, ask your doctor if this medicine is right for you.
Yes.
And it puts a great deal of pressure on the doctor. There's
sure.
one study that showed that when what they did was they took actors who went in to the doctor saying they were depressed,
yes,
and they asked for a specific medicine. They were not depressed. If the doctor had taken a little bit more time, he could have most likely discerned that. Although that's depression is difficult,
I
will say that. But the 55% of those patients got the medicine that they asked for. Doctors are under pressure.
Sure.
They want to please the patient.
Of course. We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Glenn Miller. a physician who's written a very good book called Empowering the Patient, How to Reduce the Cost of Healthcare and Improve Its Quality, Learning How to Relate to Your Doctor in a New Way. We're not taking calls today because this program is pre-recorded. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me say a word, since we're about halfway through the program, about a very good sponsor of Keeping the Faith over the years, the University YMCA. The University Y is having a program this on, November 9th, as part of the Know Your University program. Rebecca Ginsburg, who's director of the Education Justice Project, will be the speaker at noon at the Y on Tuesday, the 9th of November. She'll be talking about higher education in prison, the Education Justice Project. That's Tuesday noon at the University Y in Champaign, 1001 South Wright Street. And the following Friday the 9th, I guess one of these dates is not correct. I'll have to check on that. But for now, the Friday Forum on Friday will be, it's a joint program. That's why it's the same date. So it'll be the Know Your University and Friday Forum are going together, I see now, for the program on higher education in prison. So it'll be on Friday the 9th. Well, let's get back to our guest, Glenn Miller. When I was reading your book, Empowering the Patient, one of the things I was struck by was the section on defensive medicine. Mm. Tell us what that is.
Defensive medicine, by definition, is a test or treatment that the doctor does that adds no value to the quality of health care, but is done out of the fear of a lawsuit. That's a simple definition, but it pretty well covers the field.
And why does a doctor have to do that?
Because there's a couple of dynamics here. One is that people, with the technology and advances in technology in healthcare in this country, people have come to think that medicine should be essentially infallible. And so when something goes wrong, somebody should have to pay. This is particularly true in childbirth. If a baby is not a perfect child, or if there's some ongoing problem, frequently there will be a lawsuit brought because something must have gone wrong, and
sure,
Somebody should have been able to do something about that.
Uh-huh.
And so there's the expectation is that the doctors did something. There's a human error that made that. So doctors live under that cloud. I know doctors who do not carry insurance. They have a special arrangement, or, and very interesting, they work with the Amish. The Amish don't buy insurance, and they don't sue.
Sure.
So these doctors emphasize communication, emphasize working with the patient in ways that we've just talked about, in an effort to communication can prevent a lot of the defensive medicine kind of problems. Now, let me say that bad things do sometimes happen. The biologic diversity is a fact of life. We react to medicines differently and so forth. And some of those things are not predictable. And so most countries where lawsuits are not permissible, there is a way to provide compensation who had a bad experience that was not predictable.
And in an era when we no longer believe, at least most times, that doctors are somehow divine beings, gods that can't make mistakes, if there are mistakes, is it ever morally permissible, you think, to sue, to have this person be made more aware of their problems, or perhaps not make that mistake again, or perhaps even be pushed out of medicine?
Well, for the time being, I think that's the route. Now, let me say, I would much prefer that arbitration, this be taken to arbitration of medical experts who are agreeable to both the injured person as well as the doctor, and to that together they come to a decision. Clearly, if someone is having repeated episodes when he or she has bad results that are either negligence or errors in the way they practice medicine, they need to be brought to task. And they some of those people are losing their right to practice, and they should. This is as you know, I was in India for a number of years. In India, there's no malpractice. Doctors can do most anything and get away with it. That's not a good system either.
Uh-huh.
So we do need a way to keep doctors to account, and to that due diligence day after day after day takes care of the patient in proper ways and prevents the errors of omission or commission.
Let me correct something I said earlier about the University of Hawaii and its program. That is a Tuesday program. The 9th of November is a Tuesday when Rebecca Ginsburg will be speaking on higher education in prison. I wanted to correct that while it was still close. Dr. Miller, when you suggest that patients take a list of questions in for a doctor, but you also suggest they take in a list of the current medicine they're taking, if they have any chronic conditions, most recent test results. And you say in your book it's very important for patients to ask for their medical records. Why is that so vital?
An up-to-date medical record that you have available to hand to that next patient. Let's say you take a trip. You're outside your own community. You're outside your own the sphere of your own doctor, your own hospital. You end up in a car accident, for example. You have an emergency. You end up in the emergency room. I have seen patients in that kind of a situation who actually we spent 3 hours treating the patient for a drug allergy because there was no record of them being allergic to this medicine, which delayed treatment for their injuries in the automobile accident. A medical record can save your life in that sense. I had a friend of mine who was on a train. He was traveling by himself. He got sick, something acute in his abdomen. And he ended up going. They took him off the train at his destination, took him to the hospital, and he died. He died not of what was going on in his abdomen, but because no one knew that he had diabetes, and his diabetes was wildly out of control. Uh-huh. A 42-year-old man who had just adopted a small child. These things are tragic. These things are preventable. It is possible to drastically improve the quality of your care if you can carry a record. Another thing, you end up in the emergency room for any reason. The doctor there, because of what we talked about, defensive medicine, doctor there doesn't know you. That doctor is likely to order, quote, a battery of tests and sometimes go overboard for a minor head injury, order a CT scan of the head, for example, because he doesn't know you. If you have a record, that record will give the doctor much more information. He will be more at ease with treating you and know what has been done in the past. It is estimated that 1 in 7 laboratory tests could be prevented if people had carried their record with them. It is also estimated that 1 in 20 hospitalizations would not be necessary if people had their medical record with them. That's a huge area of cost and inconvenience and so forth.
And potential danger for the patient. You mentioned in your book that you carry your medical records with you. How do you do that? Where?
I have in the book there is a form. I followed that form. I have a one sheet, and I've had some significant medical history in the past, but it's all on one sheet. The doctor won't take time to read through 8 or 10 pages.
Sure.
It needs to be summarized. The important things we've talked about, what chronic diseases you're being treated for, what what medicines you're on, drug allergies, previous surgeries. These things, if you cover those, that will immediately give the information that a doctor needs who doesn't know you.
You provide that form in your book, and you also have sections at the end of each chapter where you, well, in the first section at least, where you have a list of things that you, for example, in this chapter 9 on wellness, what you can do to enhance your health and wellness. And I thought that was a particularly interesting list on that chapter because you start out recognizing how human we all are by saying, only write down 2 or 3 things you want to improve on.
Right.
If the list is too long, we're not going to do any of them.
That's right.
And even with 2 or 3, we may not get to number 2.
Yeah, I also.
Or even 1.
In that chapter, I also talk about procrastination and my own experience of procrastinating as I wrote that that little piece on procrastination. It's so easy to put things off. You're not doing bad things. You're doing good things, but you're really preventing doing the things you want to and need to do because you just don't get around to it. You procrastinate.
When you talk about the need for exercise, everybody these days hears that we're, as a nation, getting more and more obese. We're getting out of shape. It causes all sorts of problems physically. But to do 3 exercises a week, most of us don't do it. What can you suggest?
Well, I think look at the numbers, look at the statistics in terms of longevity, what it does to longevity, and look at the quality of life. That's a major item. I just had a friend of mine just yesterday who said he started working out about 3 months ago. He said, I can lift things I didn't know that I could lift. I can go up and down stairs now without getting short of breath. The quality of life is a major issue. And I think many people would be really surprised at how the quality of life improves as they just get on a regular exercise program. It's not only quality of life, but it's also the self-image, self-esteem. And one more thing. It's pretty clear that for whatever reason, a regular exercise program, physical exercise, is an antidepressant. People tend to avoid depression who are on regular exercise.
One of the longest sort of personal stories in your book is from a woman who, I think it was a woman, I may be forgetting that, but the person had diabetes diagnosed.
Yes.
and went and they said, well, you know, here's various medicines you can take and here are the tests you can do so you know how much medicine to take. And the person did a little research after that visit with the doctor and found out that if she dieted carefully and watched her carbohydrates and lowered the carbohydrate intake, she might not have to take medicine at all.
Right.
Tell us why that happened.
Well, first of all, that was a man who has a woman. He has a name that could be either a man or a woman.
Okay.
Yes, well, in that case, his doctor sort of just very abruptly said, here, take this information, go home and read it. He read that information, wasn't happy with it. It didn't seem to be relating to his problem. And so he started looking at it and digging. and found out that, indeed, he has a lot of control over his own diabetes. He found, through some actual testing that's in the book, ways that he actually tested himself, he found out what his tolerance was for sugar. How much sugar could he eat before his blood sugars went up? And so he put himself on a diet that strictly regulated that sugar. And with that program, he did lose some weight, which was also helpful. But he now feels much more in control, and his diabetes is actually in control, which is prevents all of those tends to prevent a lot of those complications and so forth.
And you point out that people who sell diabetes medicine have no motivation to do the diabetes education as to diet, because they'll sell more medicine and they'll sell more of the little testing kits that say how much medicine you need, whereas I'm not saying it's easy to cut back on carbohydrates. I ate ice cream just last night, but but it's possible.
Right. You know, that I should tell you, that was his research more than mine. And not that I don't necessarily share his experience. You know, in general, drug companies are in it to look at the bottom line. They want to sell their medicines. That's their job. That's how they make money. That's how they make money for new research. But sometimes it gets a bit overboard. As a matter of fact, some people have postulated that drug companies have medicines for which they are looking for a disease. And there are certain diseases that I could mention where it seems to fit that category. Uh-huh. That's their primary concern. And so my friend Lynn looked at that with a lot of a jaundiced eye, if you will. And that was his conclusion, that in their literature they simply were not empowering patients to take care of themselves. The first concern was to let them know what the medicine could do and so forth.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Dr. Glenn Miller, author of Empowering the Patient: How to Reduce the Cost of Healthcare and Improve Its Quality, Learning to Relate to Your Doctor in a New Way. It's available in paperback at a very reasonable price, I'm happy to say, and about $15. And I can recommend it. I've enjoyed reading it, and I found it helpful in my own thoughts about relating to my various doctors. Dr. Miller has been twice abroad practicing medicine through the Mennonite Central Committee. We started the program by talking about that. If you've missed part of this program, you can hear it at your own convenience via your computer at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. We're not taking calls today on Keeping the Faith because this program was recorded earlier when Dr. Miller was in town in September. Dr. Miller, there was a case reported in the paper just this morning about a motorcycle accident, and someone who had not been taking diabetes medicine was apparently, his diabetes was very much out of control, and he crashed into the crash scene, causing more difficulties and injuries. Why is it patients don't take medicine once it's been prescribed?
Well, it's hard to know about this particular case.
Of course.
But he may not have known that he had a problem. That is the reason that diabetic screening, particularly in people with a family history of diabetes, is really very important. Why people don't take medicine in general? we all think we're immortal. Don't need that. Men particularly seem to have that attitude, and so I can handle this. I don't need medicine. That seems to be a very common kind of thing. I would guess in a situation like this, it's more likely that he didn't know he had a problem. And once again, the screening, regular screening is important.
You talk in your book that one way to reduce health costs is to see your doctor regularly. It sounds like that wouldn't be the case.
Well, if you're in good health, if you are have no symptoms, and let me say that the symptoms are important. In medical school, they taught me that listen to the patient; they're telling you the diagnosis. So, if you don't have symptoms, 80%, well over 80% of diagnoses tend to be made at least as strongly suspected from the history, from what the patient says. Uh-huh. So, if the patient is not if a person has no complaints, I certainly would not. I'm not suggest running to the doctor.
Right.
You saw my chapter on the Amish.
Yes.
The Amish have not. That's one of the things they really find ways to care for themselves.
Uh-huh.
They find home remedies. An Amish bishop I talked to hadn't seen a doctor in 7 years. He was obviously healthy. And he couldn't even say, he couldn't even tell me the name of his doctor. Didn't remember the name of his doctor.
But they're also exercising regularly, eating very healthy foods.
That's right.
And they're in a supportive environment.
Exactly, and no smoking and some other things like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do the Amish drink alcohol?
No, generally not.
No.
They have their. There are folks who, but in general, that would be forbidden.
What about soft drinks?
Soft drinks. I don't know this for sure. My guess is that they would say it's not forbidden, and the bishop makes these decisions. It's not forbidden, but it's not part of the simple lifestyle. It's
sure.
not a it's not frugal living, if you
sure.
will.
Sure.
And so why do you need it?
Uh-huh.
And so my guess is that it would be more on that basis.
And a lot of fresh vegetables.
Absolutely.
Fruits.
And as you say, good exercise. The interesting thing in our area, many more of the Amish are now working in factories. And so they come under different set of pressures, particularly keeping their large families active and
yes.
involved. Before the child, a boy, particularly when he's 8 years old, he's starting to help milk the cows and things like that.
Sure.
That's a changing dynamic in the Amish community that they're having to deal with.
You suggest in your book listening to your doctor, but you also suggest stay out of hospitals as much as you can. How do you do that?
You stay out of hospitals by keeping yourself healthy. You stay out of hospitals by preventive care, which does mean being tuned into your own symptoms, but checking in with your doctor and doing some screening kinds of things. I think you can also stay out of the hospital by thinking ahead and thinking how you might care for certain kinds of situations in your home. Increasingly, there are home services available that are much cheaper does not require hospitalization. Let's take a broken leg, for example. In days past, that might have been hospitalized. If you plan ahead or post-op care for hip replacement, knee replacement, if you plan ahead, it's ways to reduce hospital stay or even prevent it. So I think planning ahead is important. Clearly, hospital is the most expensive kind of thing. Once you're in the hospital, the way you utilize services is very important. Ask questions. If a doctor says, I think you need to be in intensive care, ask why. What can you do there for me there that isn't being done? Intensive care is very expensive. So it's a matter of, again, this collaborative arrangement And I, in no sense am I suggesting that that the quality of care should suffer. The thesis of the book is that how to reduce the cost of health care and improve its quality. Not in all cases will there be improvement in quality. Let me just give you one other example. A recent study on people in their last 2 years of life with chronic disease. Those people, it was found that the things that lent to high hospital cost was the length of stay, the number of procedures done, and particularly the number of specialists. And I just heard a story from a friend of mine, 94-year-old father, who died. He was ready to die. He said, "I've had enough of this life," 94 years old. But a series of specialists came in to see him, and he was in the hospital 10 weeks and then died. His organs were failing, and each time another organ would fail, they'd get that specialist in to look at it and see what could be
done. So he did not have any any prior directives?
He did not. And I ask his son, what could you do differently? And I think it's those kinds of things about thinking ahead. Advanced directives is one really important thing that you can do to reduce the cost of health care and, in some cases, stay out of the hospital. I should say, too, Steve, that majority of people say they want to die at home. 67% of people die in the hospital.
Huh.
And we have to look at why that is.
Why that happens. Right. So it really helps. It's necessary, as you point out, for family to know, as well as your physicians and your lawyers, what you want, what you intend in the last days of your life.
Right.
Yeah. There's been a lot of fear and criticism about the new national health plan. What do you think about it?
Well, I think, first of all, I think something needed to be done. We lived in the in United Kingdom, in London, and the day after we got there, my wife came down with shingles. In 3 hours, she saw two doctors. She had four prescriptions. She and no one ever asked, who's going to pay for this? Irish friends of ours came to this country, and their daughter fell off some monkey bars the first week of school, and he told me very emotionally, before they ever asked me in the emergency room, what's wrong with your daughter, they demanded to know who's going to pay for this. Now, I asked myself, where would I rather live, you see? What kind of community, what kind of society would I rather be a member of? And it comes out in favor of where we take care of each other. And so I think that helps guide my thinking. In terms of the health care bill itself, I think it's a first step. I think it's imperfect. I think it will continue to be revamped and revised and tweaked along the way. I have friends who are otherwise very fiscally conservative, who are convinced that the answer to most economic problems lies in the open market and free enterprise. Some of them are saying to me, we're going to have to get to single payer sometime, and this may be a step backward in the speed with which we get to single payer.
When you were practicing in Ohio and a poor person would come to you, what would you do?
Well, first of all, wouldn't have asked whether they're going to pay or not.
Or if they had insurance.
If they had insurance, that's right. We would not have asked. But then when it becomes clear that a poor person cannot pay and don't have insurance, at that point we would discuss with them. I found it very interesting, however, that when we offer to at one point we went through our accounts receivable, and we had a number of people who owed money, and I wrote them a letter and said, "Talk to us. We're willing to reduce this or forgive it."
And you said only one person came to see you.
One person came to see me. And it was – and I'm not sure how to evaluate that. I'm not sure what that meant.
It may have something to do with human sin.
Okay. All right.
We've talked about the drug companies. Let's talk about the other part of it, too.
Okay.
On a show called Keeping the Faith, we could even use that word.
Okay.
We have about 9 minutes left in our program today of Keeping the Faith. Our guest is Dr. Glenn Miller, author of Empowering the Patient, How to Reduce the Cost of Health Care and Improve Its Quality. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. This is a pre-recorded program, so we're not able to take comments or questions, which I regret because this subject would certainly draw in a lot of both, I'm sure. But let's do the best we can for the time we have remaining. You mentioned in your book that in your own personal history, once you got to Haiti, once you got to India, you were living in some of the poorest conditions, poorest countries on earth, and yet you found the spirit of the people often very positive, mm-hmm. in spite of their illnesses, their poverty, their hunger. What did you learn about that?
Well, it tells me the strength of survival instinct, for one thing. But more than that, I think when people are poor, there's a generosity. They realize I'm poor, but so is everybody else, and I want to, and we're in this together. And so that spirit of generosity in the city of Calcutta, where we lived for 7 years, we found a book is out called The City of Joy by Dominic Pierre, LaPierre. And I came to ask myself, why would he call Calcutta the City of Joy? And I found that in general, there is joy there. And what I attribute that to is the fact that people in Calcutta simply have low expectations of what life owes them, and so instead of these low expectations, when you have a good meal, it's a source of joy and real pleasure.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, if you have high expectations, you may go through the day repeatedly, three, four, five times a day with real frustration because something isn't living up to your high expectations. And so so it's that. It's the expectation. Our housekeeper, Rose, came to us one evening and said, "I'm really worried about my daughter who lives in London." Why are you worried? Well, they just got a new car. Why is that a worry? She said, "I'm worried that they will have so much they can't help wanting more."
Uh-huh.
And now Rose had lived in the worst slums in Calcutta. Yeah. Rose knew poverty. Yeah. Rose knew how people took care of each other.
Uh-huh. When you're in Calcutta, you met Mother Teresa, probably a future saint. The Catholic Church. Tell us about that.
Well, I first met Mother when the organization I was with had their 50-year celebration, and she was a keynote speaker. Frequent in India, the flowers, the leis, the welcoming flowers didn't arrive on time. So the onset was delayed by 20 minutes. Now, that's not a problem in India. So during those 20 minutes, Mother had arrived on time. So during those 20 minutes to a half an hour, we had time to just sit and talk. And that's the first time I'd met her. At that very first visit, I learned of her vision in September of 1946, when she was, after having served as a teacher a cloistered school in Calcutta, a very elite girls' school. She was on a train trip to the north for her annual retreat, and in her words, Jesus appeared to her and said, "Come out from behind the walls and take care of the poor." And so it was from that that she began working with the poor in Calcutta. Mother Teresa is a remarkable, remarkable person. I was always interested in the balance between her intense focus on helping the poor and her humanity. I mean, when you were with her, you had her full attention, and you knew that there, with 3,000 missionaries around the world in 110 countries, you knew that there must have been many things she could have been thinking about, but you had her full attention.
And she demonstrated her care for you when you had a heart attack in those years in India, and wrote to you.
Yeah, I had a in the course of getting letters and cards. One of those was from Mother Teresa, and it was a card, a postcard kind of, with the picture of Jesus carrying a lamb, followed by some sheep. And in the lamb that Jesus had in his arms, she had written the word "you," Y-O-U. On the back side of the card, she had said, "Dear Dr. Glenn Miller, be the little lamb in the arms of Jesus. I will pray for you to get well soon." Now, someone had once asked Mother, "How do you take care of so many people? You and your missionaries relate to so many people." And in her simple way, she said, "One at a time." And so I became one of those one-at-a-time people where I got her attention despite all of her responsibilities and outside pressures.
When you left India and came back to the States, was there a culture shock? We only have about a minute.
You know, that was interesting. When we went to India, we were grandparents, and we had a grandfather clause in our contract that said we could come back once a year, and we did that. When we came back from Haiti, after having been there for 2 years, that was much more of a culture shock.
Was it?
You got to get accustomed to having electricity all 24 hours a day, to having warm water when you want it, to communicating in your native language and so forth.
But you and your wife consciously chose a relatively simple lifestyle, particularly for a physician in America.
Well, we always felt that we would be somewhere else doing something different, and a simple lifestyle made that possible. It's clear, had we made other choices, we would not have been able to go to India.
We've been talking today on Keeping the Faith with Dr. Glenn Miller, author of Empowering the Patient, a new book, How to Reduce the Cost of Healthcare and Improve Its Quality, Learning to Relate to Your Doctor in a New Way, a book filled with suggestions that are very practical, easy to read, and inexpensive to buy, about $15. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Let me announce again the joint Friday Forum Know Your University event coming up November 9th. That's a Tuesday. Rebecca Ginsburg, who's the director of the Education Justice Project, will be talking at the University Y at noon about higher education in prison. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants. Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.